BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is the podcast of BBC Inside Science, first broadcast on the 7th of August, 2025. Hello, US Health Secretary Kennedy pulls $500 million in mRNA vaccine research. Why? And what will the fallout be for scientists and society? Also, we meet the most powerful computer in the UK to see what it's up to. Plus, we asked, you really delivered. Stay tuned for a Tom Lehrer-inspired Elements Fest. And broadcaster Caroline Steele joins me in the studio to talk through the most distractingly sexy breaking science stories of the week. Caroline, what are you talking about?
So I've got astronomers using satellites to chase a mystery object, what really killed Napoleon's army, and divorcing birds.
OK, looking forward to that. But let's start with the money. $500 million of it. That's how much the US Department of Health and Human Services declared this week that they were cancelling from mRNA vaccine development. You probably best know mRNA from the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. It's a new technology and it won the Nobel Prize in 2023. In short, mRNA delivers genetic instructions into your cells and then your body does the work of producing a harmless copy of the pathogen and the antibodies to fight it. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a long-time vaccine sceptic, but he says the reason for pulling the funding is based on claims that mRNA technology poses more risks than benefits for viruses like COVID and bird flu. But before coming to office, he's repeated a number of widely debunked claims about vaccines. For example, claims that vaccines cause autism. We've got the latest press release in front of us, and joining us to scrutinise it is Professor Anne Willis, Director of the MRC Toxicology Unit at the University of Cambridge. Anne, welcome to Inside Science.
Nice to talk to you.
First off, can I read you this? The data shows these vaccines fail to protect effectively against upper respiratory infections like COVID and flu. Let's fact check that. Is that true? And what data might they be referring to?
That's not true. The COVID RNA vaccines were highly effective against severe infection, and they were moderately effective against systematic disease, and they saved millions of lives.
OK, so what data might they be talking about? Is there any data to the contrary?
No, none at all. They're very effective vaccines. It's hard to know where they're coming from on that one.
OK, then we've got this. We're shifting that funding towards safer, broader vaccine platforms that remain effective even as viruses mutate. Is that him saying vaccines aren't safe or that they can't cope with mutating viruses? What's the research say to that, Anne?
I think it's mixing up several things at once here and coming up with something that's not quite correct. Some of the other older vaccines, for example, against measles, are very efficacious for a very long period of time. You don't need to change those sorts of vaccines. But things like flu and COVID, the viruses themselves rapidly mutate. So you're always going to have to update and change those vaccines as they move forward. There are older vaccine platforms out there that would work, but it doesn't mean the RNA ones don't work. They are safe and they are effective. So that's not true at all.
Can I just check vaccine platforms? What's that mean here?
Oh, I mean, things like the Chadox vaccine, which is a viral-based vaccine. Other platforms can include using an inactivated version of a virus.
So vaccine platforms just means different types of vaccine?
Yeah, different types of, the whole range of different types of vaccine technologies out there. The real plus for the RNA vaccines are that you can make vaccines really, really quickly. So you could go from a virus to a vaccine in probably 6 to 8 weeks. A standard vaccine might take up to 6 months to make. And the other thing is they're very cheap to make as well.
So quicker and cheaper are two things in favour of mRNA vaccines. But to go back to this press release again, it goes on to say technologies that were funded during the emergency phase but fail to meet current scientific standards will be phased out in favour of evidence-based, ethically grounded solutions like whole virus vaccines and novel platforms. First off, what's a whole virus vaccine mean?
You purify the virus itself and then you inactivate it, often by heat inactivation. So you would be vaccinating somebody with an inactive version of the whole virus. And that can be effective. The one that they made for COVID wasn't hugely effective because often when you heat viruses up to inactivate them, you can end up changing the proteins on the surface. So you don't always get a brilliant response to a whole virus. That's another way of doing it. But again, that's a slow type of thing to do.
Okay. And also, Anne, within that statement is the suggestion that mRNA vaccines were good enough during a pandemic, but actually now that we're no longer in a pandemic, we don't need to use things like that that fail to meet current scientific standards. Is that true?
No, not at all. I don't know what they're referring to here. The work's been very carefully done. The scientific standards was as high for any other vaccine. It was all passed by the MHRA, FDA, for example. Things were fully properly scrutinised before they went into people. There was nobody cut any corners here. This is all done properly with the same standards applied to the RNA vaccines as it's applied to any medicine product that goes into humans. So that's simply not true.
Okay, well, thank you for the fact-checking. I mean, it is a bit baffling, then, that this is the way that the Department of Health is going to go. Can we talk about the implications if half a billion is withdrawn from this area of research?
In the UK, and I guess in Europe, we are more enlightened on the RNA vaccines compared to what's going on in the US at the moment. These new advanced therapeutics, they call them, of which the RNA vaccine technology is one, is a priority area with funding in this space within the UK. But it's a real disaster for my colleagues in the US. This work will just stop. And also, if they were concerned about the safety, I'm not sure what they're referring to when they say this, surely the best way to actually improve things is to do more research, not cut it altogether. This technology is transformative, not only for making vaccines, but also for the cancer vaccines that are coming through. They're all RNA-based and they are phenomenal, will save lives. And the same technology for the RNA vaccines can also be used to make protein replacement products that can be used to treat rare diseases. If you stop the development of one aim, one part of the technology, it'll have broader implications as well as just on the vaccine work.
How will that affect people who would otherwise get these vaccines?
It's a bit hard to know. I mean, the real risk is that there's another pandemic comes through and America won't be prepared.
This must be really frustrating for you, no?
Yes, I mean, it is frustrating and profoundly disappointing because it's not based on scientific fact. It's based on a number of loosely thought through ideas that have been pulled together to kind of, and basic misunderstanding and misinformation, particularly around the safety.
Okay, well, thank you, Professor Anne Willis, for joining us. I think you've been incredibly clear on what the science actually is.
Thank you. It's very nice to talk to you today.
And if listeners want to hear more about the US cuts to science, can I recommend the documentary White Coats versus the White House with Roland Pease? It's on Sunday lunchtime on Radio 4. Staying with the big money projects, the UK's most powerful supercomputer is now up and running. It's hoped that the £225 million computer developed at the University of Bristol will be able to use AI to develop new drugs and vaccines, among many other things. Inside Science thought we'd like a closer look. So here's reporter Dan Welsh.
It's a quiet day here on the outskirts of Bristol, and there's little to give away that in the big glass-fronted building next to me is the most powerful computer the UK has ever seen. Isambard AI is, of course, named after one of Bristol's most famous sons, the 19th century engineer Isambard Kingdom Brunel. His Clifton Suspension Bridge, high above the River Avon, has become one of the city's most iconic symbols. Now, both the team here from the University of Bristol and the UK government are hoping this new supercomputer will help bridge the gap in the global AI race. Well, I'm joined here by Professor Simon McIntosh-Smith, Director of the Bristol Centre for Supercomputing. Hello, Simon.
Hello.
Now, we are just outside the room that houses Isambard AI. We're in a big black cage, but then inside that cage there is another structure. Can we go in and have a look?
I'd love to take you inside to see it.
Okay, so here we are. It's a lot cooler in here than it is outside.
It's much cooler. We have to keep the air temperature really quite ambient so that the system doesn't overheat.
When we talk about technology progressing, a lot of the time we seem to almost measure that progression in terms of it getting physically smaller. You look at the massive early computing devices shrinking down until they could fit under our desks at home and then becoming laptops we could fit in our bags and then smartphones we carry in our pockets. That isn't the case here, though. This is huge.
It is still pretty big, but actually, in some ways, they have still really shrunk down. The miniaturization has continued. So what we're looking at in this room is about 12 meters by 12 meters of hardware equipment. In the past, this would have been something sort of football field size. So they really have shrunk down.
So we've walked in here and we can see there are various banks and there's a big wall of what look like lots of different almost plug-in devices, and there's various red and blue wires coming out of them and linking them all together. This isn't your typical computer, is it?
It really isn't. The whole thing is constructed of many, many processors all in parallel. And Isambard AI is optimized for artificial intelligence. And so for that, we use the very latest AI optimized processors from a company called NVIDIA. We connect them all together with a super fast network. The network is 200 gigabits, which is something like 2,000 times faster than the network you'll have at home. And we connect nearly 5,500 of these NVIDIA chips all together to make this one big supercomputer.
So this is the most powerful computing device the UK has ever seen. And along with another supercomputer called Dawn at the University of Cambridge, a smaller supercomputer that you're going to be working with, it's increasing the UK's computing capacity to 23 AI exaflops. What on earth does that mean?
It's a huge measure of performance. It's almost like our sort of miles per hour rating. And what's it really mean? To put it into context, if we had everyone in the world do one little calculation every second, so maybe you add two numbers together or multiply two numbers together. If everyone on Earth did that every second, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, it would take everyone on Earth 80 years to do what Isambard AI can do in just 1 second.
So what does this amount of computing power allow you to do that couldn't be done before? I imagine you're not going to be using this to play Minesweeper.
I certainly hope not. But the kinds of things that are possible, the first one that people kind of hear of today is things like training large language models. So many listeners may have played with things like ChatGPT. We actually didn't have the ability to train something like ChatGPT in the UK. But now with Isambard, we do. And actually, even the latest large language models, the biggest ones coming out of the big companies, we can now train those from scratch in the UK. So we can create UK versions of these things where we know exactly what data went into them, you know, exactly how they were run. So that's called a sovereign AI capability. So that's one of the big things that's now going to be possible with this level of compute power.
Well, we can also speak to a couple of the scientists who are starting to use Isambard AI to help power some very innovative research. We're joined by Dr. James Pope, Senior Lecturer in the School of Engineering, Mathematics and Technology at the University of Bristol. Hi, James.
Hi.
You are investigating how to better detect cancerous moles in different skin tones.
Yes, that's correct. AI models may be able, and people are using them, to detect whether it might be cancerous or benign. And what we were interested in was, might there be tone bias? In other words, might it work better for lighter tones than darker tones? And we were interested in answering that question.
We sort of hear about these perhaps unintentional, but of course really serious biases in medicine, perhaps because of clinical trials not having been run on a widely representative range of people. Really significant problem. So how are you using this supercomputer to try and help resolve that in this case?
So what we did is there were existing data sets out there, and we thought that, well, maybe there might be a bias because, as you suggested, there were many more clinical trials of data with lighter skin for skin cancer than darker. So we corrected for that. We actually addressed that. And really what we needed was a good AI model that would be able to classify cancer and benign. And to do that, it took a lot of computing power, and we needed that. And so that's actually what Isambard did for us.
Where are you at in that process at the moment?
So we got access to Isambard, and we're able to show that there was bias with three data sets from a commonly used data sets, that there was actual bias. In other words, it did do better for detecting cancer in lighter skin tones than darker skin tones. And the next step will then to see exactly what that is. So we know it's not the data balance. We addressed that. So now we want to understand, using explainable AI techniques, to understand where that bias comes from, and then think about how we might mitigate that. So those are the next steps.
And could you have done this in the past without this kind of computing power?
No. So as an example or a little bit of an idea for training the model on one set of hyperparameters took about 5 hours on one of our high-end servers at the university. We needed to do this like 10,000 times. So it's just not something we feasibly could have done without Isambard.
Well, thank you, Dr. James Pope. I'm also now going to head to speak to someone who's been using Isambard to analyze how we carry out everyday tasks around the house.
I am Professor Dima Dahman at the University of Bristol in the Department of Computer Science.
So, Dima, tell me, what have you been using Isambard for?
We started using the pilot version of Isambard AI to analyze footage from wearable cameras. So these are footage of people just putting a head-mounted or a glass-mounted camera and going around doing their daily lives. And our objective is to understand what they do, why they're doing it, and what do they plan to do next.
What is it that you're looking for in that, and what do you hope it's going to be used for?
There are two things we're trying to do. One, to basically interpret this and assist the human, the person wearing the camera. But there is also a huge potential for this to do imitation learning for robotics. If we're able to understand how a human naturally perform a task, will we get robots to do that? Many people say robots are still very far behind. They're very, you know, because we're feeding them instructions of how to do things. And people wonder whether if they just learn by observing, whether that will give them the agility, the naturalness that humans can perform tasks in. And we can only do that by observing and analyzing footage of humans just doing what they do naturally successfully.
Well, let's have a quick look at some of the footage that you've gathered from people filming themselves all around the world.
This is a recording in Italy, and we can see just people going around, opening cupboards, unzipping bags.
So this is somebody in their kitchen in Italy.
Yes, this is someone in the kitchen in Italy. They look like they're unpacking their lunch bag or something, and they're discarding some of their cutlery. We're moving here to footage actually from the UK, and we see people slicing through an onion.
Now, you've got all of this video footage. Why do you need to use this new supercomputer, Isambard, to analyze this? You couldn't do that before.
Despite the fact that we collected this amazing resource of 3,600 hours from these 900 people, we never were able in the UK to put all this resource together into one project. But thankfully, because of Isambard and because of this investment, we will, for the first time, 3 years down the line, be able to do some of our ambition, put all this footage and be able to understand goals and intentions and be able to predict what people could do next. This is in particular very important as we think about the potential of these devices to be able to give warnings, to give advice, all the way from reminding someone who might have dementia about how they did a particular action before, to warning a factory worker about the risk that they're doing, like something they shouldn't be touching. So there is plenty of potential if we are able to anticipate what people should do next from footage, and that's our project.
Well, I'm back with Professor Simon McIntosh-Smith, and Simon, we've been hearing about just a couple of the pieces of research this supercomputer is being used for now it's fully powered up. This site has been funded by the UK government. It costs a lot of money. Why is this so important to the UK government and where it places the UK in terms of the global supercomputing world?
Well, I think artificial intelligence is expected to be one of the next big disruptions, almost as big as the internet, could be as big as steam power even. And if that's true, we really need to be at the forefront of this revolution. You wouldn't want to be left behind when the internet was coming out or when steam engines were being developed. So if it really is that big, we need to make sure the UK is at the forefront of all of that, and we need the computing power to enable that, and that's really where Isambard AI kicks in.
Simon McIntosh-Smith there, Director for the Bristol Centre for Supercomputing at the University of Bristol. Caroline Steele is with me in the studio. Caroline, before we get stuck into this week's new discoveries, I've got something to play you, something of a treat. So satirist and mathematician Tom Lehrer died last week. Now, he's best known for his Elements song, which lists all of the elements in the periodic table. However, it was first recorded in 1959, and guess what? Science has moved on. So, last week, we challenged our Inside Science listeners to update his Elements song for, in the words of Ian from Hayton,
All the new elements now on the shelf, named after countries or after yourself.
Excellent. So, new elements, new songs, please. Pleasingly, but also unfortunately, you've sent us more recordings than we have time to play, but let's hear a few of our favourites. Here's Alan from North Allerton.
There's dubnium and borium and hassium, nihonium, seaborgium, meitnerium and also rutherfordium and tennessine, fluorovium as well as copernicium, laurentium, muscovium and tasty livermorium.
Thank you,
and
Alan. That was good.
I feel like we might have a new Inside Science theme tune there.
I think we might. Do we have to pay royalties? I don't know. Moving swiftly on from that terrible thought. We've got a very poetic submission from Diana in Farringdon.
Muscovium, organosin, the US helped with tennessine. The fourth is from Japan, nihonium, land of the rising sun. Each of these four new elements contracts two letters. Here we go, NH, MC, TSOG. I do prefer to sing this slow. And though my chemistry is silch and not a known reliance, I can sing of elements, they're real. I must tell Inside Science.
Wow.
That was beautiful.
Yeah. Diana, congratulations. What a range. You hit the high notes and the low notes. William in London sent us this, along with an apology to his school piano teacher.
The element preceding were by scientists created, but the half-life is just seconds, so it's rather complicated.
Yay! I'm going to have this tune stuck in my head, at least for the rest of the day. That was incredible. Honestly, what a spread.
What a spread. I mean, we've got one more to play us out, but I think the late, great Tom Lehrer would be proud, though. Now, from stars in their eyes to comets in our vicinity, right, Caroline?
Yes. So, Marnie, have you heard of 3i Atlas?
No, I can't say I have.
So it's an interstellar object that's currently hurtling through our solar system, and it's going to swing around the sun and disappear back into the depths of the cosmos within the next few months. And it's only the third object that we've ever detected that's entered our solar system from outside of it.
So are we going to let it alone, or are we going to interfere with it?
Well,
for science.
So astronomers are looking at whether or not we have a chance of landing on or flying near this object to learn more about it. But Atlas is moving at 60 kilometres per second, so it's not going to be easy. There are proposals to reroute NASA and ESA missions already in space, or to repurpose sort of shelved spacecraft projects and launch them. But it is a huge ask to suddenly launch a spacecraft or redirect one. It's not as easy as it looks in the sci-fi movies. So personally, I'm not holding my breath. But I did stumble across an interesting project that's coming up. So ESA is currently working on the Comet Interceptor spacecraft, which is due to be launched in 2029. And the plan is for it to just loiter, waiting for the discovery of an interstellar object that it can survey. So it would be perfect for when the fourth interstellar object enters our solar system. And then we can really work out what it is, because we genuinely don't know what this object is. It's probably a comet. It could be older than our solar system, so it could be like 7 billion years old. But it's a bit of a mystery, and we're not going to be able to learn that much about it unless we can get closer to it.
Talking of mysteries, what really killed Napoleon's army?
Okay, so should we start with a little history lesson?
Yeah, sure.
So Napoleon and 600,000 troops invaded Russia in 1812, and it didn't go very well. So they retreated, but the process of retreating was really, really dangerous. About half of the soldiers were wiped out by disease, starvation, extreme cold. And historical reports from survivors have sort of suggested that typhus and trench fever were the two main causes of death. But French scientists have done some really interesting state-of-the-art DNA analysis on the teeth of 13 soldiers which were buried in Lithuania, which was one of the main places where retreating soldiers died. And they found no evidence of typhus or trench fever.
Oh, a mystery. So what have they found evidence of?
So instead they found the bacteria Salmonella enterica, which causes paratyphoid fever, and you get that by ingesting food or water contaminated with feces of someone else who's infected. Lovely. In any extreme scenarios, it can kill you. They also found Borrelia recurrentis, which is transmitted by body lice. It causes relapsing fever, and it's not often fatal, but in an already weak soldier, it could well have been. So scientists may have just basically completely turned the historical records on their head. But these haven't been published in a peer-reviewed journal yet, so the jury is sort of still out. But it's quite cool that we can even do this, I think. Like, DNA analysis could be used to sort of fill in the blanks in historical records, or, like in this case, even correct them.
Thank you, Caroline. And finally, divorcing birds.
So this is my favourite one. A paper's been published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B, and the paper name is great. It's called Timing and Social Dynamics of Divorce in Wild Great Tits. So great tits are these small, like, yellow and black birds. They're monogamous, they have one partner at a time, and from breeding season to breeding season, some birds will stay with their partner while others will split and find a new partner.
Okay.
But what's long been unclear to scientists is how the birds' behaviours in the non-breeding season affect or determine whether or not they stick together or divorce. But there's this amazing project called the Wythenwood Great Tit Project, and it's studied wild bird populations for over 75 years. And data from this study shows that early signs of divorce can be seen in the winter, so in between breeding seasons, months before the couples make the choice whether or not to pair up or move on and find a new partner. Which, again, sounds quite human, you know? With friends, you can sort of tell sometimes months before they break up just by bickering.
Well, exactly. I was going to ask, what are the signs? Is it, you know, how can you tell if some birds are squabbling?
So they're not that surprising, I would say. They spend less time together. They visit feeders at different times, and they stop showing a preference for socialising with their breeding partner. And generally, these effects sort of increase over time. Which basically shows that bird divorce, like human divorce, is a socially driven process. Which, yeah, I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah, a family that eats together stays together as well.
Precisely, that is what the science says.
Well, thank you very much, Caroline. That's us out of time, unfortunately. Send your comments and questions to insidescience@bbc.co.uk. We'll say goodbye from Caroline.
Bye-bye.
Bye from me, and we're going to play out with one more favourite Tom Lehrer update. This is John in Hereford.
This periodic table song, it used to list out all of them, but 60 years later, we find there's many more of them, like Hassium, Siborgium, Dubnium, Laurentium, Organosum, Muscovium, plain old Rutherfordium. I might have missed a couple, like Neonum and Borium, but if I'm being honest, I'm slightly more than bored of them.
You've been listening to BBC Inside Science with me, Marnie Chesterton. The producers were Jonathan Blackwell, Dan Welsh and Claire Salisbury. Technical production was by Sue Mayo and Matt Chamberlain. The show was made in Cardiff by BBC Wales and West.